Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. We have one case on submission for the 130 docket. It is cause number 0320463 CV, Department of State Health Services versus Crown Distributing et al. Before I ask for announcements, I'm going to give some general instructions for those of you that are joining us online and for the participants in today's proceedings. First, the case will be simulcast through, it's simulcast on the internet through YouTube, both the visual and the audio. When we are concluded with argument here today, only the audio portion will be available to the litigants and to anyone who's interested on the court's website, but it's only the audio file that will be available. And that should be done later today. As instructions to the attorneys for both sides, the appellants they are going to have 20 minutes total. I'm assuming that there are 5 minutes reserved. If that is not the case, then I'm sure someone will let me know that. For both lawyers that are involved here today, when you get to 2 minutes left in your argument, whatever portion that is, the yellow light will come on. So that's what that means. When you see the red light, that means your time is up. Please feel free to finish answering whatever question or argument that you were making, but do not proceed further without further seeking leave of court. And I think that that is the only instruction that I have for everyone here today. So let's go ahead and get started. This is 0320463 CB, the Texas Department of State Health Services et al. Versus Crown Distributing. And for the appellants,
Charles Eldred for appellants.
Thank you, Mr. Eldred. And for the appellees,
Shane Pennington for appellees.
All right. And unless there's anything else, or if you have any questions about the procedures, let's go ahead and get started. And Mr. Eldred, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. The trial court issued a temporary injunction enjoining the Department of State Health Services, otherwise known as DSHS, from enforcing the rule. The court should reverse the trial court's temporary injunction because the rule is valid as a matter of law. And that satisfies the abuse of discretion standard for appellate review of temporary injunctions. The rule contains four prohibitions and they're best looked at in groups of two, two groups of two. The rule's manufacturing and processing prohibitions are valid because they do nothing more than repeat a statutory command that DSHS adopt a rule prohibiting the manufacture and processing of smokable hemp products, and that is found in section 4.
Mr. Eldred, it's a little difficult to hear you. You may be far away from your microphone, or there might be another device that's sort of echoing, but I think you're just getting this, we're getting some kind of weird feedback, so it's difficult to hear you.
Is this any better?
Much better.
The manufacturing and processing prohibitions are valid because they do nothing more than repeat statutory language, statutory command in section 443.204, subsection 4 of the Health and Safety Code. And moreover, plaintiffs do not challenge the validity of the rule's manufacturing and processing prohibitions as invalid. In fact, in their pleadings, they repeatedly said these prohibitions are valid exercises of statutory authority. And I cited them in great detail every time they did that, pages 4, 5, 6, and 7 of my brief. So they received more relief than they argued for. And if they had challenged the rules, manufacturing and processing prohibitions, that challenge would have been prohibited by sovereign immunity. Because rules that merely restate statutory language, there is no sovereign immunity to challenge those rules. There is sovereign immunity to challenge those rules under 2001-038A. And I cited 5 cases to that effect on page 16 of my brief. Now I think they're going to say that they did challenge the manufacturing and processing prohibitions, the validity thereof, because the manufacturing and processing prohibitions, the statute that requires those prohibitions is unconstitutional. I got 3 responses to that. First of all, that's not a validity challenge. That's a different kind of challenge. Second of all, that it would be barred by sovereign immunity, like I just said. But Maybe most importantly of all, they also challenged the statute itself, and the trial court denied relief. So the trial court said there was no probable right to relief on their claim that the statute is unconstitutional. It makes no sense for the trial court to have also enjoined the rules manufacturing and processing prohibitions, which are required by that same statute. That demonstrates the plaintiff's lead argument is wrong. The trial court's temporary injunction is not based on plaintiff's challenge to the constitutionality of the statute. It can't be because the judge did not grant relief on that challenge.
But didn't I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Judge Triana. Mr. Elder, but didn't the judge enjoin the entire rule and not just the portion of the rule about sale and distribution?
Correct.
So does that support an argument the other way, that she felt like they were all unconstitutional and that's why she enjoined the entire rule and not just part of the rule?
Well, again, if that just wasn't before the court, there's no argument based on that before the court. I think what the judge did was she looked at it as rolling it back to the status quo the day before the rule was adopted. And I think that's very easy to see that was a wrong approach to take with respect to the manufacturing and processing prohibitions for the reason I just said. Those prohibitions are required by the statute, and you can't challenge those prohibitions as invalid anyway because of sovereign immunity. And even if you did, the judge denied relief on their constitutional challenge. So,
Mr. Elder,
go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you, and it's an enunciation issue. I mean, not that you're not enunciating, but whatever's coming back. So can you repeat what you said? Did you say that what you think happened was that the judge was trying to go back to what?
The status quo of the day before the rule was adopted. I think that's what she said she was doing in a temporary restraining order proceeding. I think that may be how she was looking at it. I think that explains why the ruling is what it is, because plaintiffs did not ask for the relief of the manufacturing and processing prohibitions to be enjoined as invalid. They asked for the relief that those be enjoined as unconstitutional. That's a different challenge, and she denied that challenge. And hopefully I'm speaking more clearly. I'm sorry I'm not coming through.
I don't think it's your fault. I think it's a technological issue. So did you just say that, in your estimation, that the appellees did not argue, that they did argue for the injunction based on the unconstitutionality of the rules? Is that what you just said, but not of the statute?
In their pleadings, they only said that the distribution and retail sale prohibitions were invalid under 2001-038A. They never said the manufacture and processing prohibitions were invalid. In fact, they repeatedly said they were valid. And I quoted all the times they did so. So,
but
now then they go ahead.
They are asking, they did ask the trial court to enjoin, let's just deal right now for a second with manufacturing and processing. They are claiming that the statute is unconstitutional. Both statutes are unconstitutional, and they did ask for an enjoinment of that. Can you tell me if we were to conclude that the trial court impliedly found the statutes unconstitutional? Let's just assume that's what we think. Can you tell me then what would be your best argument for why the temporary injunction, even under that, should not proceed as written by the judge?
I'll just say quickly, she plainly did not do that because they asked for that specific relief and she didn't grant that relief. But if she had granted that relief, I think the argument would be very different. We'd be talking about the general authority to adopt rules under 443.051, because the limitation on that authority in 443.2044 would be unconstitutional in that scenario. So it would be a completely different case, Your Honor. I don't even know what the argument would look like. Maybe we wouldn't be here. I don't know. We'd probably be here on something on a different issue than we are here right now. in my opinion, the issue right now is that the court should not have enjoined the manufacturing and processing prohibitions without also enjoining the statute. It's not possible. It's not logical for her to do that. And again, I think it's explainable because of her view that she just needs to roll back the status quo to before the rule was adopted. But they're not entitled to that relief because they didn't ask for that relief. They did not ask that those prohibitions be found invalid. So I'm happy to move on to the other prohibitions, which is not as easy for me, but I think it's funny easy enough. The rule also requires that says that distribution and retail sale of smokable hemp is also prohibited. This rule is an outstanding example of an agency that's pulled together several different parts of a statutory scheme into one place in a rule where the regulated community can see exactly what the law is without having to find it themselves. Dishes is more familiar with these statutes than anybody, I would think, and they know what the statutes mean. So let's go through that. It's an allowable interpretation of their rulemaking authority. It's one of the reasons we have rulemaking in the first place. So go back to 443204. It's entitled Rules Related to the Sale of Consumable Hemp Products. But then subsection 4 talks about manufacturing. Well, why does it talk about manufacturing in a rule that's in a statute that's supposed to be about sale? Well, because there's some steps to get there. Subsection 2 of the same statute says that products containing one or more hemp-derived cannabinoids, such as cannabis oil, I'm pronouncing that right, a CBD, intended for ingestion are considered foods and not controlled substances or adulterated products. That's important because the definition of manufacture of food is found over in section 431.002.23a.
So, Mr. Eldred, I have a question before we start going down that road. The legislature knows how to include words and knows how to not include words. So I get where we're going, I think, is to imply that broad prohibition of all of it, as opposed to just the manufacturing and the processing, but then we're expanding upon that to also include the retail sale and smoking. Is that the argument that we're starting to go down now?
Yes, but I don't agree it's an expansion. If you put all these statutes together, the word manufacture also includes the ban on manufacturing includes a ban on retail sale and distribution because of these.
Are there any other provisions out there like this where we have a specific prohibition for certain conduct, and then from that we kind of infer a greater prohibition of a whole bunch of different things? I mean, because the legislature's usually pretty good about including those words, and do we get to even add additional words to the statute in absence of ambiguity? And if so, where's the ambiguity?
There's no ambiguity. So no, we're not adding words to statute. We're simply, in our view, we're showing what manufacture means, because the plaintiffs like to talk about in their constitutional argument how absurd it is that you can buy a consumable hemp product and bring it home and chop it up and smoke it, and that's allowed. But see, manufacture doesn't apply to that. Manufacture applies to making a consumable hemp product for smoking for sale, both at retail and wholesale. So that's not even the issue about whether you can smoke this stuff at home by yourself. The issue is, can you sell it and can you distribute it? And that's why the rule is so great, as far as I'm concerned. It shows that even though it says manufacture, it also applies to retail sale and distribution. And that's because of the definition of manufacture. It's also because of section 201A, which says a person may possess, transport, sell, or purchase a consumable hemp product processed or manufactured in compliance with this chapter. But you can't process or manufacture smokable hemp in compliance with this chapter. So therefore you can't transport, sell, or purchase it either. And again, the rule is just pointing these things out. And I hope I'm answering your question. I don't think we're adding words or even interpreting words. We're just showing what manufacture means and what the other parts of the statute means, and pulling everything together so everyone can see. But even though it says manufacture, that there's more to that than you may first think of that. Now, plaintiffs, they've argued the rule.
Mr. Eldred, going to Judge Goodwin's point, then would you agree that in Chapter 443, the legislature distinguished between manufacturing and selling when in creating licenses, separate licenses for manufacturers of consumable hemp and separate registration for sellers?
I think that's correct. But again, consumable hemp for smoking, smokable consumable hemp is defined as a food. And manufacturer, okay, so DSHES regulates food, drugs, devices, and cosmetics. And manufacturer is defined differently for all four. And the reason it's important that the smokable hemp is defined as food is because you have to look at the definition of manufacturer for food. And that's where we bring in the manufacturer for sale and at a wholesale or retail. And DSHES will kill me if I don't say this. No other smokable product is known as food in any other known law. But this law very specifically calls the smokable product a food. And it may not make any sense to people, but that's what the law says. And therefore, you have to look at the definition of manufacturer of food. And I hope I answered the question. I was going to say that the plaintiffs say the rule is invalid because it supposedly violates 443206, which addresses manufacture of products from outside the state. And supposedly it violates a federal law, which preempts states from regulating the transport of hemp products through the state. The reason those arguments don't help them is because that's not their argument in this case. They are not trying to say that they want to do either of those two activities. They're making a facial challenge to this rule. Now, those two issues are interesting issues, but they're not here today, and we may hear about them in the next case. That's why those arguments don't work. We request the court reverse the trial court's temporary injunction and render judgment in that sense. And if you have no more questions, I'll get back to the rest of my time.
Mr. Pennington?
May it please the court. Before I get into addressing some of the specific things that Mr. Eldred talked about and some of your good questions, I just want to frame things a little bit and emphasize that the court doesn't need to reach the merits here at all. The reason for that is that it's just a well-settled rule that this court's very familiar with, that when there's a judgment and there aren't findings of fact and conclusions of law where the trial court has not said the basis of its ruling and where there are multiple potential bases for that ruling, this court will uphold the trial court's judgment on any basis supported by the record and will presume that the trial court made the findings necessary to support its judgment. And the result of that and the implication of that for appellants, of course, is that if they want to reverse, get a judgment reversed on appeal, they must attack each potential basis for the trial court's ruling. If they don't, and they only attack one, then the presumption that favors the trial court having made the findings necessary to support its judgment on the alternative ground means that this court should affirm. And in this case,
well, is that true? I mean, so we're trying to determine at the outset the TI, right? This isn't the merits.
That's right. Correct.
And so preliminarily, you had to give to the trial court a plain and intelligible statement for the grounds for the relief. And the grounds for the relief, as I understand them, are that the statute is unconstitutional. Yes?
Yes.
And on the TI, the trial court said, I'm going to enjoin the rule, but I'm also going to deny in part. What was the deny in part about?
So just to back up a little bit to answer your question, we raised two claims. One was the one that you articulated, that the statutory authority was unconstitutional. That's the legislative ban. We also challenged the validity of the rule, and that was in a separate claim. We asked for declaratory relief along those lines. The statute's unconstitutional, the rule invalid. And to preserve the status quo, we sought a TRO and a TI that just barred defendants from enforcing the rule. The reason for that is that the statute, the legislative ban, is not self-executing. In other words, the way that it is worded is as a command that the agency create rules.
Make a rule, right.
Exactly. And so in the absence of a rule, there was the irreparable harm that surely is looming and is there in the background, right? It just hasn't been activated. And so just out of an abundance of caution, and because, you know, it made sense to us to ask for the court to enjoin enforcement of the statute as well, you know, the future enforcement, for example, so that the defendants couldn't just pass another rule that did the same thing on the back end or something like that. But the trial court, we believe prudently, said, well, that's not really necessary to preserve the status quo. So even if the whichever ground the trial court had for granting the TI, it could have been, look, I think that there's been a showing of probable right to relief on the constitutional claim. What do I do to preserve the status quo? Well, I bar enforcement of the rule. And by doing that, I have preserved the status quo, prevented irreparable harm. So we move on.
But then, so something was denied though, yeah?
Yes, Your Honor. That's because we, in our original application, we asked for the statute to be enjoined, which would have gone even further. It would have been a belt and suspenders approach, which of course we would
have. And that's where the constitutionality, that's where the constitutional challenge comes in, is on the enforcement of the statute. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Is that where the constitutionality comes in?
No, Your Honor. In order to enjoin the statutes, mm-hmm. the enforcement of the statutes, the trial court would have had to have found that we had shown a probable right to relief on the constitutional claim. However, the fact that the trial court did not grant a TRO or TI barring enforcement of the statutes does not show that the trial court made a finding that we did not show a probable right to relief. The reason for that is it is a belt and suspenders sort of thing. You know, if you just need a belt to keep your pants up, and here, you know, If the trial court found that we had shown a probable right to relief on a constitutional claim, all it needed to do at the TRO and TI stage to preserve the status quo and prevent irreparable harm was bar enforcement of the rule. And there's evidence in the record. If you look at the clerk's record at page 282, this is the actual TI. And, you know, in the middle of the, well, at the end of the first paragraph there on 282, the trial court says, this temporary injunction prevents plaintiffs from suffering irreparable harm until the court can decide the plaintiff's constitutional and other claims. So, and further, the court goes out of its way to mention the manufacturing, processing, retail sale, and distribution bans, all part of the irreparable harm that was found, all are enjoined from being enforced. And in doing so, the trial court, we argue, did find that we had shown a probable right to relief on the on the constitutional challenge. The fact of the matter, though, is the defendants could have asked for findings of fact and conclusions of law, and we could have clarified this. That wasn't done here. So the point is, we don't, even if I'm wrong and you're not convinced that I've proven that the trial court made this overt finding on the constitutional claim.
The first question.
Yes. Even if I haven't convinced you of that, as long as it's possible on this record that the trial court did and that ground was in front of it, the appellants had to attack that ground in order to reverse the trial court's judgment. If they don't attack every potential basis for the judgment, and there are alternative bases, it's settled that this court will affirm on the alternative ground that is supported by the record. And so that's why we don't think that you need to reach the merits, but I don't want to go so far with this that I don't get to the other points. So I'm happy to answer more questions about that, but for now, I'm just going to sort of dig into the, if you do reach the merits, there's every reason to affirm. I mean, let's just start with.
Let me get back to relief just a little bit. Can we reverse in part and render in part a TI?
Yes, I think that you have authority under the rules to do that.
We don't have to send it back.
No, I mean, I think that there are, in the abstract, there are circumstances where that's possible. Whether it's possible here, I'd have to think of a more specific example.
I'm kind of thinking along the lines of, not only on the remedy issue, but on the abatement suggestion that was made by the state. And I just wanted to know if you have comment on that.
Yes, we think that that's very important, and I'm glad that you brought it up. So just to back up a little bit, as far as just a part, you know, a remand, say, affirming in part, reversing in part, for example, on the TI, I think it's important to bear in mind that the court generally doesn't grant relief that the appellants didn't request. And in their prayer for relief, in their briefing and in the reply brief, both the opening and the reply, defendants just sought, you know, a reverse and render. That's it. And so I'm not sure that in these circumstances, just looking at the TI, that this court has authority, unless there was some sort of equitable thing that I'm not thinking of, to do a partial affirmance and deny and remand. Now, the question that you raised, I think, is a very, very important one, because this case raises, or has come to raise, an important constitutional issue that this court's, I'm sure, quite familiar with at this point. And that's the constitutionality of Rule 24.2A3. And just to get to the nub of it, the defendants filed a letter notifying the court about the In Re Texas Education Agency decision from the Texas Supreme Court recently. And that decision, you know, while it definitely made clear that Rule 29.3 relief is possible, and defendants concede that, what it didn't address is that window, that gap, where because of the operation of Rule 24.2A3, the temporary injunction necessary to prevent irreparable harm while the appeal is pending is dissolved. And in this case, it was just a couple of days. And thankfully, you know, the whole world didn't collapse on top of us during that time. However, as we detailed in the brief, and I won't belabor it, but this creates a zone of basically no protection to liberty for even the most important constitutional rights, including, you know, voting rights. For example, you can imagine a scenario where there's a TI necessary to protect minority voting rights on the eve of an election, a notice of appeal, pop, voting rights go poof in Texas. And that just cannot be the law. And we challenged this and we raised this, and it's right and it's briefed. And we were injured. I mean, we had to brief and spend the time and the energy to do this emergency motion. You know, we warned the trial court. If you look in the reporter's record, I'll track down the exact site while I'm talking, if I can chew gum and walk at the same time. We told the trial court, we telegraphed, look, this is going to happen because, you know, we were aware of the issue, and it's going to continue to keep happening. And this court is going to be bogged down with emergency motions for who knows how long, and the rights of Texans across the state are going to be in jeopardy in a very bizarre and frankly indefensible way. And so that's an important issue, and I submit respectfully, I think the court has to reach it. The reason is because this harm occurred. It's already occurred. It's complete in this case, because there was that window where RTI was dissolved. We did not get a hearing. We did not get any sort of opportunity to be heard on that before it happened. It happened. We had to fight it off with briefing in this court. in order to get the temporary relief on 29.3, we raised the issue. And so it's live.
But my understanding is the stay was affected. Yes. The temporary stay was affected.
Yes.
And so, so aside from creating more work for ourselves, I mean, is that still an issue?
It is. And here's why. I mean, the whole, again, just sort of like fundamentals of appellate law, like this court is obviously thinking not just about this case, but about the next case and the next case. And is
Rex issue, I mean, that's not before us in other than to abate the appeal. As the appellants had asked us to do. Isn't your challenge to that statute, isn't that on the merits, not on our TI, our dealing with the temporary injunction right now?
It's an interesting procedural posture because we have two constitutional challenges and kind of different procedural postures. I mean, the first is related to the TI and whether the trial court found a probable right to relief on our challenge to these statutes in the health code. The other, this one that arose afterwards, is the challenge that we raised to 24.2A3 once our TI was dissolved and we were made vulnerable to the irreparable harm that the trial court had tried to protect us from through the TI. And so, of course, in this case, just to sort of circle back to a question I can't remember which justice asked, but in this case, yeah, it does look like, well, look, it's just work. You just had to brief something. That's easy to say for the lawyers, but for our clients, this was very real. And we knew it was coming and we, you know, the trial court knew it was coming. And again, as an appellate court, you know, if you wait until the sky actually does fall before you do something, when you have it ripe in front of you,
Mr. Pennington, that was my kind of flippant statement, and it's more along the lines of, which is why you asked for the temporary stay, and which is why the court immediately, I think, entered the stay. I wasn't suggesting that you shouldn't be working, or that your client should needlessly pay for the briefing, but I think that is also why the court immediately considered the stay at the time. Recognizing exactly what you're talking about.
But my question, Mr. Pennington, is do you contend that issue as to the, you know, constitutionality of 24, is that before us right now, or is that something that we would be considering on the merits, assuming this comes back to us?
I see. I'll admit I hadn't thought about that. I should have, and I had not thought about that. That's a good question. I guess it is the sort of thing just off the top of my head that could be carried with the case to final judgment. On the other hand, it is ripe, and so it is briefed. I would need to think more about it to give you a more thorough answer. I'm sorry. It's a good question. I hadn't thought that through, actually. But to get back to, I really want to get a little bit deeper into the merits here with a few minutes I have left. And I just want to address a couple of points at sort of a high level. First, when we're talking about the agency's rulemaking authority, under, I believe it's 443.051 of the health code. I hope I'm getting that right. Yes, it's, you know, it's broad rulemaking authority. The problem is that the way that it's being used here to take manufacturing and processing and to turn that into, oh yeah, also retail sale, oh, and wholesale sale, oh, and distribution as well. When you have a statute that is, you know, adumbrates out each one of those different concepts and it weaves through the statute in a very structured and organized way. The idea that the legislature would have thought of these things as just being lumped together and is hard to believe. And when defendants say that, look, all we did is just help the citizens out here and make explicit what was already implicit, I I'm not sure. I mean, if as a citizen, it just wouldn't give me much comfort to see words like manufacture and processing being extrapolated into just any old thing at any old time without any basis. And when the statute uses those words in very specific ways throughout. So when you get down to it, rulemaking authority may be broad, but what the defendants are asking for here is a rule that would say anything that's not forbidden is permitted. And in under long established law in Texas and frankly, the United States, it's actually the opposite. It's that agencies are creatures of statute. They have the authority delegated to them by the legislature and not a bit more. So we're not, it's not a anything not forbidden is permitted regime. It should have to be things that are necessarily implied, things that are reasonably necessary to accomplish a task. And we made the arguments in our brief, and I won't belabor it, but the idea that a distribution and retail sale ban is in any way necessary to accomplish a manufacturing and processing ban, it just doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Pennington, I asked Mr. Eldred the question of how do we imply a broad prohibition from a carved exception? Are you familiar with any other statutes that do that?
No, Your Honor, although I would say I think that Mr. Eldred probably knows more of those statutes than I do off the top of my head. I have looked and I have not found any. We cited in our case we cited a couple of cases in our briefs that were from involved public utilities. And those were the cases that we found that were closest on point. And we think they cut our way. So, and if the court doesn't have any further questions, appellees ask that the court affirm the trial court's order entering the temporary injunction, grant the Rule 29.3 emergency relief, and hold Rule 24.2A3 unconstitutional. Thank you.
Mr. Pennington, before you go.
Yes, Your Honor.
The TI was denied as to the constitutionality of the statute, I think generally. There's nothing in there expressly. So, and y'all didn't appeal from the denying part by the trial court. Is the constitutionality of the statute before us? Boy, that's a big question to leave on, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. I do think it's before you at least this much. While the court didn't grant our request that barring enforcement of the statutory ban, we submit and we would strenuously argue that that does not equate to a finding that we did not show a probable right to relief on the constitutional claim. And the reason is because we're in a temporary injunction posture where the idea is to preserve the status quo and to prevent irreparable harm. And the trial court prudently, presciently realized all that it had to do to accomplish those goals in the most minimally intrusive way was to bar enforcement of the entire rule, which is what we asked for and what it did. In our proposed TRO at the beginning of the case and in our proposed temporary injunction. So we would submit that at the very least, it is not clear what grounds the trial court based its order granting the temporary injunction on, and defendants could have asked for findings of fact and conclusions of law. The fact that they didn't means they needed to challenge each ground, each possible basis for the trial court's judgment.
Thank you. Mr. Eldred.
Thank you. The disconnect here is that plaintiffs never asked for the processing and manufacturing prohibitions to be declared invalid under 2001-038A. They agreed they were valid. And their request that the statute be enjoined as unconstitutional was denied, as you pointed out, Justice Goodwin. So there's a statute that's still on the books.
That was a question. I mean, that's the implication, but I think Mr. Pennington addressed it as part of the analysis on the rule and their probable right to relief. Could you address his arguments in that regard?
Well, they've been trying to rewrite their arguments ever since the hearing. They submitted an email to the court staff 4 days later making the argument they're making now, which is that, oh, we really were arguing about the constitutionality of the manufacturing and processing prohibition. That's not in their pleadings. The pleadings were that the distribution and retail sale prohibitions are invalid. They agreed the manufacturer and processing prohibitions were valid. They didn't even talk about that. They talked about the statute, which requires dishes to prohibit manufacture and processing. The statute that is not enjoined, that's on the books right now, that requires dishes to have this rule. So dishes has to have that part of the rule right now under the current law. And that's why I think that the trial court's approach to just roll back to the day before the rule was adopted was really incorrect with respect to manufacturing and processing. Just two more points that I have. We are not extrapolating the word manufacturing in the old way we want, or in some sort of everything not prohibited is allowed. We are not extrapolating at all. We're simply using the definition of manufacture as it applies to food, which, as I stated before, smokable hemp products are food under the statute. As strange as that may sound to many people, it's food under the statute, and they haven't challenged that argument. Manufacturing then entails retail sale and distribution. So we're not extrapolating. That's just not correct. The 24.283 issue is not for you. This is supposedly the argument was made in a footnote on page 2 of Appellee's emergency motion for Rule 29.3 temporary relief. And it says, the state's use of Rule 24.283 to supersede a temporary injunction entered to prevent irreparable harm also raises grave questions as to Rule 24.283's constitutionality under the 14th Amendment. And then it follows with some boilerplate quotes from cases. That's not an argument that's before the court. It's not before the court. And furthermore, the argument is against the idea that the state can automatically stop a temporary injunction by appealing, by filing an interlocutory appeal. Well, we can't. After all that's happened, of course, in March, the Texas Supreme Court issued NRE TEA, and it said basically that instead of having to plead this to the district court, you now have to plead to the appellate court. So, and it did plead to the appellate court. This issue is not before you. The issue is academic as well. So I don't think the court should make any ruling on 24.283. Except if you do get to it, I will still continue to say that 29.3 relief is not appropriate against the manufacturing and processing prohibitions, because I keep going back to this, and it's a disconnect between the parties, I think. The manufacturing and processing prohibitions were never challenged as invalid. They're now scrambling and trying to say, oh, no, we challenged this other way, this constitutional way. They don't connect the dots. It's not in their pleadings. It's only in an email and in an appellate briefing. It was not before Judge Livingston. Judge Livingston didn't rule on that. So it's just not correct to say that she made a constitutional ruling, except one ruling she made, which is that the statute is, well, she did not enjoin the statute. So she found a probable right. She did not find probable right to release on their claim that the statute is unconstitutional. And that fact destroys everything they say about constitutionality, including the argument that we had to shoot down the constitutional issue as well to win on this case. It's just not there. The constitutionality of the statute is not a basis for the temporary injunction. The only temporary
is Mr. Pennington correct that if there is any basis upon which her decision could be based, that it was an incumbent upon you to ask for findings of fact, conclusions of law, and help us along that determining whether or not she was right? And if there's any other basis that we have to affirm, it's either affirm in all or reverse in all?
Not in this case, because the basis is very clear. They asked for the rule for the distribution and retail sale prohibitions to be found invalid under 2001-038A. They never asked for the manufacturing and processing prohibitions to be invalid under that statute. They now say again that they asked for those to be declared unconstitutional.
And there's no way to say to sever those out or say, affirm in part, reverse in part, or anything like that. It's all or nothing.
I don't know if I put it that way, because again, we don't think manufacturing and processing is really here. The court should not have been joined to begin with. So I guess we do think that you could possibly do that. You could possibly say The manufacturing and processing prohibition parts of the rule are back, but we don't agree with dishes on the other part of the rule. And we're going to affirm that part of the temporary injunction. And the reason that the prayer reads the way it does is because, again, we just don't accept the fact that the manufacturing and processing prohibition argument is before you.
So let me ask one last question from my part. So if, it seems to me that you are pretty clear and adamant that the judge found, you know, that there was no truth or no legs to the constitutional challenges to the statute. And that's kind of where you hang your hat on. It's, you know, it, once that's done, that's the end of the hunt. If that's the case, why do we have a temporary injunction that also includes manufacturing and distributing?
I think it's because, I'm sorry, say that again.
Manufacturing and processing. I screwed up.
I think the judge explained that in her TRO order, which was that she just wanted to roll it back to the day before the rule was adopted. So she knocked out all four prohibitions because she wanted to roll it back to the day before the rule was adopted. Not because she found the manufacturing and processing prohibitions to be invalid. And she could not have found that. They didn't ask for that. They only, and so that's why I don't think it's not possible for her to find it invalid, which because they didn't ask for that.
Anything else, Judges Kelly or Triana? All right. Anything else, Mr. Eldren?
No, Your Honor.
With that, the case will be submitted. This panel is adjourned for the day. And thank you, gentlemen, for fine argument. We appreciate it.
Thank you.